When a pizza delivery person rings our doorbell, my dog acts differently than when any other stranger shows up. She really loves crust, and our hypothesis is that she can smell her favorite food through the mail slot, and based on prior experience, she knows she's likely to get a few pizza bones tossed her way while the humans are eating. That's a form of imagination, right? Picturing what is possible before it's happened. What she probably can't picture is, say, watching our coffee table turn into a giant pizza before her eyes. As far as we know, the ability to imagine what is not possible is a talent only humans possess. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. So what is so special about our gift for daydreaming about what could never really happen? Is that sort of creativity just a quirk of our big human brains, or has it given us a survival advantage? Science writer Philip Ball is here to talk about this. You can read his article, Homo Imaginatus, at Eon. Philip, welcome to Think.
Thank you, Chris.
How did artists of the Romantic era define imagination?
Well, yeah, this is the good question to start with, because, you know, we talk about imagination a lot and we imagine that we all mean the same thing, and we don't necessarily. And it's meant different things at different times. I mean, we could go back even further to, say, the Renaissance or the Middle Ages, when people felt that imagination actually had a power to change things in the world just by the power of the mind, really. It had a power to create entities, to bring forms and demons into reality. So there's this famous line in Shakespeare's A Midsummer Night's Dream, where Theseus says, talks about imagination bodying forth the forms of things unknown. And by that bodying forth, he really means you can somehow sort of make them concrete in the real world, that you can conjure, you know, beings out of nothing. Now, in the Romantic era, so, you know, the early 19th century, there was a sort of different view of imagination that kind of saw it as a spiritual agency, really, that it was something, I guess they would have said something God-given, that, you know, that this ability to project ourselves into other times and places and bodies was something they would have considered uniquely human, and special, and part of our sort of inheritance as special beings that God had created. These days, there's interest in trying to figure out, to decode what imagination might be in terms of what our brains are actually doing. So, you know, that's shifted the question a little bit.
So modern scientists disagree about the reason we possess imagination. What are the two main camps in that debate?
Well, I'd say there are several camps. And, you know, to begin with, again, it really comes down to what we're talking about when we think about imagination. The neuroscience literature, to my mind, somehow has often a rather limited view of it. So often when they talk about imagination, they're talking about the ability to create mental imagery, to create a picture in our mind. And, you know, that's a particular skill that we have that uses certain parts of our brain, including the part that deals with vision, even though, you know, we're not actually literally seeing the things through our eyes that we're imagining. But I guess I feel that this is just one part of imagination. And I think one way to think about that is that there are actually people who don't have this ability. It's a condition called aphantasia, the inability to actually conjure to mind a picture of what you're thinking about. And, you know, people who have this condition wouldn't be able to think of even a well-known or loved friend or relative to actually conjure their face up in their minds. And yet, of course, they would recognize them when they saw them. And yet, I think it would be quite wrong to suppose that people who lack that ability lacked imagination in a more general sense. So, you know, that's one area in which imagination is talked about. But other people have talked about it in terms of the ability to, there's this phrase called mentally time travel, to project ourselves back into the past, to kind of, you know, we do it all the time, to kind of think about what happened yesterday, to think about what happened in our childhood, but also to go into the future, to imagine ourselves and literally to visualize ourselves, you know, getting into our car and driving to the shops, or being on holiday next year, or how wonderful it would be to be able to be on holiday next year. So this is another aspect of imagination that's somehow broader and perhaps somehow starting to touch on what really this ability that we have is getting at.
So there are obvious benefits, right, to being able to picture what is possible. If you see a rock and you realize it could be used as a weapon or a tool, that's going to create a survival advantage. Is it possible that the earliest hominin toolmakers could only visualize things that could really happen?
Well, the honest answer to that question is we just don't know, because we don't know what sort of brains they had. But I think it's fair to say that there's no clear indication that there was any big jump in what our brains could do or imagine compared to between Homo sapiens, say, and our early ancestors, Homo erectus or Homo habilis. In some sense, we seem to have had a similar mental toolkit. So I think it's quite reasonable to imagine that they might have been able to do something of that sort. But when we're talking about something like imagining what you could use a rock or some other implement to do as a tool, it's really important to recognize that humans aren't by any means the only animals that can do that. There are plenty of other animals that can use tools. Birds can do that, particularly the group of birds called corvids, the ravens and rooks and crows. Certainly other primates, other great apes can use tools. Elephants can do so. So this ability to see something and, you know, as we would say it, to kind of think, hey, I could make use of that to, you know, get at these grubs, to dig out these grubs from the tree. That's something that other animals seem able to do. What we don't know is what's going on in their mind when they do that. Are they imagining themselves actually picking this thing up and doing that and, the grubs tumbling out? Or are they just performing an action that they've seen others do? Are they just performing an action that they have done before without that sort of mental imagery? That's a really hard question to answer, but it's certainly one that animal researchers and animal behaviorists are trying to find ways of getting to grips with.
But they are pretty sure that, for example, my dog really can't picture the coffee table turning into a pizza, right?
It seems unlikely, is I think the best we can say. However, we don't know what your dog can picture. You know, when you talked about your dog, perking up when the pizza gets delivered, in a sense, that sounds like the classic behavioral experiment done back in the early 20th century by the Russian scientist Pavlov, mm-hmm. who was able to. Basically, what he did was to train dogs to associate a sound with food. So, you know, the ringing of a bell, say, with the fact that they were going to be given food. Every time they heard the bell ring, they would be given food. And subsequently, once they had got used to this idea, a process called conditioning, you only had to ring the bell. You didn't have to actually give them any food or have any food in sight. Just ringing the bell was enough to make the dog salivate. And Pavlov's idea was that the dogs were just acting like machines, really, that were just being sort of conditioned into having this automatic response, and that there was nothing actually going on in the brain of the dog that, you know, was imagining, hey, there's food coming. And this was a common point of view, certainly right through until the 1950s, 1960s, with the so-called behaviorist school of psychology. That, you know, that was all animals were doing, that they didn't have a rich inner world like us. And I think today it's very clear that certainly dogs and, the other animals that I've mentioned, other primates, birds, elephants, dolphins, for example, that I think there's actually a lot more going on, and that there are reasons to believe that even if they can't, you know, imagine something that could never possibly happen, they can certainly start in some sense to imagine things that might happen and perhaps to, you know, picture that pizza on its way.
So we may not remember every detail of an episodic memory, but our imaginations fill in the blanks so we don't notice what we don't remember.
Yeah, that's exactly true, except that I would say we actually remember far less than we think we do. That the I think the amount there are far more blanks that the imagination is filling in than we'd like to think. And you know, it's likely because we know how things tend to be, it's likely that they're a pretty good guess, but sometimes they're way out. And we know this is so because, I mean, for one thing, because people all the time report false memories. I've had false memories myself of things I have been convinced have happened until I've been, you know, presented with evidence that they really didn't, or that that thing really didn't exist. But it's disturbingly easy to manipulate those memories. If we, you know, if someone just kind of tells us, oh, you remember, you know, that so and so was there, we think, oh yeah, they were. That's right. Even if it's completely wrong, our brain is very, very ready to build that narrative and to respond to all sorts of prompts, including false ones, you know, to build it into a story. So I think really what this is getting at, and you know, perhaps where we're sort of heading now, is that our brains are storytelling brains. They're made to construct coherent narratives. And, you know, that has to be, I think, the essence of what imagination is about.
We are heading there, but I want to get to one thing first, which is that you explain here that imagination requires the use of what is known as the default mode network within our brains. Before we talk about this, will you give us a refresher on what the default mode network is?
Okay, I mean, in short, it's really just parts of the brain, various parts of the brain. So there are bits in the cerebral cortex, the sort of top of the brain, the, if you like, what people often call the thinking brain. There are specific parts of that that are involved in this default network. There's a part called the hippocampus, which is deeper in the brain, and it's a part that's involved in memory, particularly memory for places. And all of these parts seem to form a network that is kind of active together. When we are, it's active when we're in the state where we're not particularly thinking about anything. We're kind of daydreaming. And so it's kind of like the resting state, really, of the brain. That's why it's called the default mode network. But it seems that this is also the network that becomes active when we are imagining. In some sense. And the idea there is that what we're doing, you know, we're never imagining anything from scratch. In fact, what we're doing is calling up the materials, just like a painter, you know, assembles their paints ready to paint. We call up the materials that we have available, and those will be past memories, you know, past sensations, and everything that we imagine is assembled out of those components, put together in, you know, perhaps new ways and sometimes in fantastical ways. But essentially, you know, we have to have something there to work on. And so that's really what this default network seems to be. It seems to be able to draw on memories and associations and really to weave all these different components together into some kind of story.
So does this mean there is no geographic region within the brain that we can call like the imagination center? It sounds like it comes from throughout our brains.
Yeah, it really does. And I think that's a really important point to remember because, you know, sometimes when we sort of read about neuroscience these days, we're invited to think that, okay, the brain just has all these little compartments. One bit deals with memory, you know, one bit deals with visual processing, and maybe one bit deals with imagination. Well, for a lot of brain processes, it really isn't like that. And certainly for something as complex as imagination, it isn't, because it draws on many different resources, you know, including this ability to visualize past memories. And it really is a process of weaving these things together. So there is a network in the brain that seems to be concerned with imagination. There are some bits of the brain that imagination does seem to use and other bits that it doesn't seem to need to make use of. But it's not one center, it's a brain-wide activity.
But if we suffer brain damage that makes it hard to retrieve memories, then we will find it really hard to imagine.
We'll find it hard to imagine certain things because if we, I mean, there's a part of the brain that deals with so-called episodic memory, which is things that happened. Okay, there are, you could broadly speaking divide memory into, you know, that aspect, remembering past events, and more general aspects of memory like remembering what words mean. So episodic memory seems really important for imagination because, as I say, that's the raw material that the imagination works on, things that we have experienced, things that have happened to us. So if we have if we have damage to episodic memory, then it may become harder to have certain kinds of imagination. And in fact, that's one of the brain lesions that, you know, if we have damage to the parts that deal with episodic memory, that can lead to a kind of aphantasia, as I mentioned before, this difficulty in visualizing things in the brain. So I guess, you know, really the response to that is that there's no one bit of the brain that if it's hit, your imagination is gone, because imagination isn't like that. It consists of many different components working together. But there are specific aspects of imagination that can suffer if specific parts of the brain become damaged.
All right, Philip, what makes some scientists think our capacity for storytelling is an adaptive evolutionary trait?
Well, there are some people who think that this is what imagination is really for, that it's for being able to communicate complex possible futures to our fellow humans. You know, so this is the beginnings of story, that we actually say this might happen. Imagine if this happened, you know, what would we do? So you can, you know, immediately see that in adaptive terms, that's a useful thing for a community to be able to do, and to have imaginative people within it who are able to construct stories that help them to prepare for things that might happen in the future. But, you know, what's interesting is that the stories we often tell are and certainly, you know, in fiction now, they're stories that never happened. And they're often stories that could never happen. Fantastical things happen in them. The laws of physics are broken in them. How could that be useful? Well, I suspect that, you know, what you're going to end up with, if a brain is designed to have the kind of imagination that can foresee possible futures, then it's going to do much more than that. It's going to, you know, it's going to be, you know, a machine for constructing all kinds of possibilities. And of course it would be, because, you know, it would have been evolved many, many thousands of years ago before we knew what the laws of physics were, before we knew what was impossible and what isn't. And of course, we still don't completely know what is possible and what isn't. So it's useful to have minds that can imagine more than we think is possible, just in case it turns out to be the case.
So it's good to have minds that can imagine what is possible and more than that. It's also good to be able to communicate those thoughts to other people. Do we know anything about which came first, the ability to speak or the ability to imagine?
No, we don't. I wish we did. It's one of the key questions, actually, in human evolution, because this ability to pass on information through language is really, it's been argued, I think, quite convincingly that this is what distinguishes humans from other animals. Other animals can communicate. They can send out alarm calls. Sometimes those alarm calls can be quite specific. You know, they might indicate a particular kind of predator. But no other creature seems to go very much beyond that. There are experiments to see how much other great apes can communicate, whether they can learn aspects of human language. They seem able to in some sense, and so do other animals like dolphins. But to construct a story in language seems to be a uniquely human trait. And whereas people have often in the past thought, well, that's a useful thing because then you can tell someone else how to make a tool, or, you know, where the food's to be found. Actually, there are others. And one of them is a linguist called Daniel Dorr, who works in Tel Aviv, who believes that actually language was invented, as he puts it, for the instruction of the imagination, that it's not just for doing very practical things. It's actually to communicate experiences, what it's like to feel in a certain situation, what, you know, to imagine these possible futures, to imagine scenarios that may or may never come to be. That really is the richness that language alone seems to enable. And, you know, it's perhaps that, that, as I said in the article, that makes us really the imaginative ape, you know, much more than the knowing or the, you know, the intelligent or the tool using ape. It's the imaginative ape, I think, that sets us apart.
You already explained that our memories are built in part out of things we actually experienced and in part out of details that our imaginations fill in, and we can't necessarily tell the difference. What do we know about why we are mostly able to tell the difference between memories of things we've only imagined and memories of things that happened to us?
Well, I think we often we're taking it on trust that we can really do that. You know, I guess all I would say is that if our if the mind reconstructed things inaccurately too often, then it wouldn't be doing a good job. It wouldn't be doing a good adaptive job. If we were having invented memories, false memories all the time, then, you know, we wouldn't be able to function well. So it makes sense that our minds, you know, are pretty good at reconstructing what's happened in the past. But I think the key point is that that's really what they're doing. They're making a best guess at, you know, what we think happened based on really often quite limited actual data, and they're pretty good at doing that. But I think, you know, it's always a surprise to find out actually how much of what we remember is a guess, is reconstructed, and is potentially false. So I would say that I don't think we have a very good way of distinguishing the two of them, except from experience, except from finding out, you know, that if we think something happened and actually everyone tells us it didn't, or we're presented with irrefutable evidence that it couldn't have done, it's only then that we have to accept it. And even then, I think, you know, our brains have a really hard time in shifting gear and, you know, accepting that we've just imagined it.
And it can be a feature of certain mental illnesses, right? When we sort of lose the dividing line between imagination and reality.
Well, there are people who suspect that some mental illnesses like schizophrenia are in some respects illnesses of the imagination. Because it does, they do seem to represent, you know, more of a breakdown of this inability to distinguish between, you know, what is real and what is purely sort of constructed in the brain, and not just in the past, but in the present too. And, you know, in a sense, I think it's illnesses like that that help to reveal to us how contingent our experience is on the brain actually doing what it's meant to do, and how, and really that's, you know, that's what we do. I mean, people have described perception as a controlled hallucination, by which they mean not that, oh, it's none of it's actually real, it's not really happening, but that we it's the same process that is going on in complete hallucination and in normal perception. It's just that in the, you know, in the case of hallucinations, it's become just too far detached from the actual sensory input that we're getting. Too much of it is being imagined. But it's only a matter of degree that, you know, in a sense, we're hallucinating all the time, but we're usually doing it, we're sort of, you know, actual sort of sensory input is keeping us closely enough moored to what is really out there for it to be a useful hallucination.
Reading your piece made me wonder whether it will ever be possible for artificial intelligence to be given something akin to human imagination.
Yeah, great question. And it's a question, it's a little bit similar to asking whether AI will ever acquire anything like human consciousness. And we don't know the answer to either of them. But there's certainly a lot of discussion going on these days about creativity in AI, which is related to imagination. I think it's not quite the same thing, but it's related to it. And certainly it seems to involve this ability to bring together familiar ingredients in new and surprising and stimulating combinations. And that's something that AI can do. So there are AI programs that, for example, compose music or that create pictures that many people find interesting to look at and to listen to. And I think that's no, in a sense, that's no great surprise. And, you know, it shouldn't unnerve us that AI can do that, because in the end, the creativity, I think, is coming from our own brains. We're simply being given the resources, by whether it's by AI or by artists, to enable our own minds to you know, exhibit their own creativity. So if if an AI creates music that, you know, we find we quite like, we shouldn't think, oh my goodness, you know, that's the end of human composers. Because in a sense, all it's doing is learning from what human composers have always done. You know, in general, they need to be trained to do this, and you train them on music that exists. And it's providing us with raw material. I think that, you know, one of the things that I always want to stress when we talk about AI creativity is that, in a sense, what it shows us is that we are part of that creative process. It's what's going on in our minds. We're not just passive, you know, recipients of all the creativity that the artists or the robots are pouring into us. We are part of that process. And, you know, I think that's an aspect of what I'd like to sort of get across in thinking about imagination too, that it's, we all have it. It's not something that only an elite group of people have. We all have, in some sense, the ability to imagine, and we should recognize our own part in that process.
Did working on this story make you think about cultivating your own capacity to imagine?
It did. Well, I mean, it certainly made me think about the number of times I've falsely imagined, and I have imagined past. I knew I had done that. And, you know, I think if we all think about it hard enough, we'll remember situations like that. I think what I found really interesting about the working on this piece was the connection to story and storytelling, and the idea that that's really what language is about, and that is central to what it means to be a human in community with others, because, you know, that's where story works.
We will have to leave it there. Philip Ball is a science writer whose article Homo Imaginatus appears at Eon. Philip, thank you so much for making time to talk with us about this.
My pleasure, Chris. Thank you.
You can subscribe to the podcast where you get podcasts by searching for KERA Think, or you can listen on our website, think.kera.org. Again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening. Have a great day.